This is The Think Tank with Dr. Mike O'Neill, talking about the major political, economic, and social issues of the week. KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com. The Think Tank.
Okay, ballots are out there. Early balloting is underway. Two propositions, significant ones, affecting the city of Phoenix. We're going to talk about both of them today. One of them is Prop 105, the other Prop 106. 105 we're going to talk about in the first half of this show. That deals with transit. Our guests are, well, let me first tell you what the Prop 105 is. In rough terms, a yes vote on 105 is a vote in favor of amending the city charter to end construction of light rail expansions and to redirect funds from that to other transportation improvements in the city of Phoenix, and to prohibit funding of other light rail development, with the exception of the Phoenix SkyTran, which is run by the airport. In other words, and I want people to be clear on this, a yes vote is the anti-transit vote. A no vote is a vote, in effect, in favor of transit. A lot of times these are the yes and the no confuses people, because, and the reason a yes vote is that the people who want to make the change have a proposal on the ballot, and we're voting on their proposal. So a yes vote is against transit, a no vote is favor, to overly generalize it, but just so people know which side is which. We have two guests. Paul Johnson's a former mayor of Phoenix, and he is a no vote on this, which means he's pro-transit. And Sam Stone is chief of staff to Councilman Sal DeCiccio, who is, I understand at the moment, cruising in Alaska and can't be here. And Sam is a proponent of the initiative, which means that he's wants to see a cutoff of funds for transit and redirection.
Well, hang on. I
do want to make sure that's a fair. And if
when,
it's not,
when you say cutoff of transit, that's not accurate. It is a shift from light rail, which is an incredibly inefficient transit system that is already outmoded, to buses and other resources for transit. We have a massive shift in transportation taking place around the world. Transportation 20 years from now is not going to look like it does today, but we're sitting here assuming it does. That's not correct.
Well, that's kind of incorrect also, though. I mean, just to be fair, it's not an outmoded mode of transportation. It's being used today. It's helping deliver a vision that we've had for the city for 30 or 40 years.
It's delivering the same vision it delivered in 1905. It's buying horse stables at the dawn of the automotive era.
No offense, that's just ridiculous. It's not even close to that. This really does come back to vision. I mean, what is your vision for the city of Phoenix? Years ago, a long time ago, when I first went on the council in 1985, we had a downtown that was dead. It was in trouble. It was a crime-infested place. And there were a whole group of people who were saying, don't spend money there. It's a waste. Don't do it. There were a different group of people. And by the way, that's a fair view. That's a fair outlook for it.
Our view was a dismal one.
A dismal one. And it's one that wasn't serving the city well. And it's one that the business community didn't like. We wanted to try to create something in downtown that gave a sense of place. Now, we put a lot of money into that place. We put money into baseball stadiums, basketball stadiums, art museums, science museums, TGen that went downtown, ASU that went downtown, connecting ASU with a light rail that fed into it. It's an overall vision of, do you want that place to work? Now, you can build roads, but here's what roads do to downtown. It takes people through it. It doesn't really bring people into it. What light rail is meant to do is to create a tie, a connection. It's not outmoded. It's doing exactly what we wanted it to do. And we're starting to see development up and down those corridors. We're seeing more people moving into them, more developers wanting to buy that land. That land becoming more valuable, adding more tax base to the overall
tax
structure.
We've added tax incentives to that land. And anywhere we've done that, we are building development. There's no difference between the light rail corridor.
No offense, that's a governmental point of view. I'm in the private sector. That's just not true. It's just not true.
We're part of the offices that approve these things.
I don't care that you are part of the office that approves it. I'm telling you, that light rail is creating an incentive for developers wanting to develop.
So why, when they put out the numbers, do they have to include things like, oh, the light rail brought in two gas stations, which clearly have nothing to do with light rail in their numbers? Because the numbers are a joke. Because it doesn't make sense.
You can say that, but you have no backup for it.
Oh, absolutely I do. The very list of the, quote, $11 billion in investment that light rail has brought in includes two gas stations.
What about ASU in downtown Phoenix?
Is that a plan that was already in place before the light rail?
Just so you know, it's not correct. There are a whole list of things that are happening in downtown that work and that become more efficient because of it. You also
and
have
that
about
can
30
be done with bus
30%
rapid
of the residents
at a fraction of the cost.
That's just not the case.
Absolutely
well,
it is.
It's
bus
just not.
Rapid
but,
transit
but,
can move more people at a lower cost.
What light rail does is it begins to change the development patterns that are in a city. Now, here's what's happening today. We're taking people in a city of Phoenix. We're saying, hey, we're going to grow. By the way, developers and light rail do not create nor disincentivize more people. They don't create them. People are created by childbirth. About half of our population growth comes from childbirth. The other half,
I would say all of our population growth worldwide comes from.
The other comes from moving in from out of state. So the question becomes, where do they go? Right? Do you want them in outer Buckeye? Do you want them in outer Mesa? Areas where you have to spend billions of dollars in infrastructure. You want to talk about waste of taxpayers' dollars.
When you bring them back into the inner city,
you're utilizing existing infrastructure. You're taking something that's there and making it more creative. You're taking my neighborhood where I live in the inner city, and you're making those property values more valuable.
There's absolutely no reason you can't do that with bus transit. And on top of this, I come
from
Boston.
Show me a place where it happens.
Actually, there's a number of cities in
Europe. Boston has a light rail.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if we were to build out
a similar system to Boston, how much would that cost, Paul?
We're not going to build a similar system to Boston.
Oh, okay, wait. So we have 524 miles of arteries here in the city of Phoenix, major streets that people have to get around. Boston has about half of that. In place, they have about 150, almost 180 now miles of rail. For us to build 300 some miles of rail, which would give us an equivalent ability to move people around our city at $153 million a mile, which is now an outdated cost figure, would be about $90 billion.
Yeah, and I think you're looking at it all wrong. That's a completely specious argument because you're taking a look at trying to build something that emulates Boston.
No, I'm trying to build something that works for people to get them around the city.
What works today is to try to create incentives for people to want to move back into the inner city, to want to live in the inner city.
Well, if you want to talk about social engineering, come on, social
engineering. You guys are so focused on social engineering in so many other ways. When you're building roadways out in Buckeye and Mesa and freeways going to places where it's improving the value of raw land for developers, that's social engineering.
Of course, those developers pay impact fees to get that.
And you know what? They pay fees in the inner city. At the end of the day, getting that growth to move back in is the part that's being missed in this debate. It's bigger than transit.
It's already happening without this, and we can provide more transit.
You say it's happening without this. What do you mean? Light rail is here. You can drive over.
It's happening where light rail isn't. There's literally no difference in the growth between our key corridors, anywhere that we offer tax breaks, the GPLAT breaks, which people don't understand. All that land along
the
light
rail. You say there's no difference.
We're offering deals where we lease the land and collect no taxes on
it. If you compare Camelback and 19th Avenue to Arcadia or the East Valley, okay, I'll give that to you. But the East Valley, it was going to grow. It did have lots of good economics built into it. Developers, retailers, others want to be there. But you weren't here to take a look at what 19th Avenue looked like before this rail. You weren't here to see those other elements. And I can tell you.
Actually, I was here to see. We're shifting.
No offense, Sam. I think you're a little younger than me. I could be wrong. But at the end of the day, that corridor is starting to happen. You're starting to see things that are taking place. And I'll give you another other answer to it. Without light rail?
You can give that answer after the break. Right. Now, we will return with our diminutive guest, and we'll see if we can bring them out of their shells to talk when we return in just a moment. We're talking transit issues in the city of Phoenix and the upcoming vote, Prop 105, when we return in just a moment, and KTAR's Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're back with Paul Johnson and Sam Stone. Let me start asking a very specific question, because Sam raised the issue of economic incentives. Are there special economic incentives given to people who want to develop a long right rail?
Well, there were. Those are starting to reduce, some because of the efforts of Councilman Saul DeCicio. I'll let Sam talk more about that than me, just because I'm not as up to date on it. But there have always been incentives to try to get people to come back in. The real question
is specific to areas around light rail, or is it to anywhere within a central city boundary?
I can tell you the city gave incentives when they were handing out incentives to people who would go in along light rail. But I will give Sam kind of the chance to answer that, because he's more involved with that daily.
Yeah, we still do that throughout the central city core, each of the village cores.
Okay, but not uniquely for transit areas.
And specifically for the light rail corridors. They are eligible under the GIPLET program. General property lease, excise
and
tax.
And that is City Phoenix.
Yes.
Because the first thing, now, I'm not a Phoenix resident, though I come in, by the way, and I drive on the, I don't see where all these bad streets are. The roads seem decent to me. And you'd always like better, but the thing that I'm a Tempe resident, and the thing I'm most familiar with is a stretch along Apache Boulevard, which was a total eyesore. It was trailer parks and junkyards and things like that. And since rail was put in, the rejuvenation of that area has been dramatic. I don't pretend to know whether or not there were incentives. I don't recall hearing about them. And I could see how that area developed because of rail along there. Without them in that, there's an area where you're within a couple of miles of the university. And for students and people who work at the university, if the rail is there, it's a couple of minutes in on a rail ride. You don't have to have a car to go into a congested area. And all of a sudden, a whole new part of town, which was very underdeveloped, is now basically a prime area.
I spend a lot of time talking to developers. I've done quite a few developments. I've been involved in that space, and I have a number of friends that are in it as well. Let's just say that you removed the light rail. Would growth have happened in the same areas? No, I don't think that it would have.
It's hard for me to think to the same extent, because right now, for a student or a young faculty member to live in that area, 2 miles away from the university, they're talking about driving their car in. And if you're going to drive your car in, you might as well be 5 miles away, because you're going to have to find a parking spot out at Sun Devil Stadium anyway.
But it is much easier with rail to get that done at Apache between Tempe and downtown Phoenix than it is up and down 19th Avenue. 19th Avenue has been a very, very tough area to get to redevelop for a long time. I was here as mayor. It was a tough area to try to get people into. In fact, in many ways, we'd kind of forgotten it. I think you're going to see the areas of development that happened first being between Tempe and Phoenix. I do think, though, that as you start to look at the scarcity of land, the price of land, going up, what it costs to be able to build in those areas, you start to see Camelback as becoming more attractive, even for things like student housing, which may end up servicing downtown Tempe.
You know, the area I think specifically we should talk about, because it's immediately related to this, is the strip along Central Avenue, because based on the results of this vote, there either will or will not be light rail going down Central Avenue. I looked at that area, and I said that has a lot of the same character of what I would have noticed years ago on Apache Boulevard.
So I don't want to dominate all the space here, but just
I'd like Sam to comment on that.
Yeah. I mean, I would look at, there's, I think, two issues here with this, right? Can light rail bring a certain type of growth? Yes. What will happen along South Central is what's happened along 19th. It's what happened elsewhere. The existing businesses will go out of business that are along there because they won't survive the three-year construction period. The owners of the land will mothball it for that time period, then sell it to a developer. It will be redeveloped with higher-end properties, likely with tax incentives added to it to create the opportunity. The problem with that is twofold. You're displacing all the legacy businesses that are built up, and there aren't many places in this city where someone with a fairly limited budget can start a business anymore on a major street. And two, Democrats like to talk all the time about the ill effects of gentrification. Well, the light rail is bringing gentrification with it when it comes and does that. So you're talking about people low-income housing and things. Student housing is not low-income housing. I mean, let's face it, with student loan incentives and all the other things, their parents, these kids are not living in $400 and $350 a month apartments. They're living in $1,200 a month apartments with a couple of their friends. So that's fine. I mean, it may create that opportunity, but what it's going to take away are the opportunities for people who are, you know, struggling to get by at $600, $800, $900 a month in
rent. Can't they just they move three blocks in? I mean, what develops is, well, is a two-block area around
Central. Right, but
then
they're not going to get serviced by this. I mean, the fact of the matter is, here in Phoenix with our temperatures, the reason only 1% of our population uses the light rail is it's the population that's directly on those corridors. If you're more than a five-minute walk away, you're not using it. People want an option in air conditioning that gets them directly from as close to from their door to their destination as they can.
Well, when we return, we're going to talk about the other proposition. We may or may not get to this, depending on time, to return to this issue. But we're going to talk about Proposition 106, which deals with spending limitations and pension funding, when we return in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The New Jerusalem.
Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We're going to shift gears here. We're going to talk about the other initiative that is in front of the voters of Phoenix, and that is called Proposition 106. And let me try to get it right. If I don't get it right, Sam can correct me. But what this does, as I understand it, is places a cap on most spending until the city's pension liabilities are 90% funded. Currently, the pension system's about 60% funded. Phoenix carries a debt of about $400 million, which is money that it will owe retirees in the future, but doesn't have socked away right now. Is that a fair statement, both of you?
More or less. The $400 million, our current pension deficit, according to the city, is $5.7
billion. The current pension
deficit
okay,
according to
all
the
right
city is 5.7
all
billion.
Right. Sam, you're the proponent. Why is this needed?
Well, because our deficit is 5.7 billion, and right now we not only don't have a plan to effectively address it, our current plan essentially guarantees that we're going to run into a point when Phoenix is in a major fiscal crisis because of this. We have to take this on now. It's a little bit like being told you have cancer and saying, I'm just going to sit this one out and see how it goes. We got to cut it out. And so right now, for instance, we're told, I said $5.7 billion. That breaks down to about $4.2 billion in our PSPRS, that's for police and fire, $1.5 billion in COPRS, which is the management side of it. The problem is, even today, we say, you go to city council, they talk about this, you'll hear them say, hey, this problem was created in the past, but now we're actually paying up every dime we need to people these days to make sure this doesn't happen in the future. That's not true either, because the numbers that are used to figure out those deficits are a negotiated number, not a real number. So that 5.7 is based on our funds earning 7.2% rate of return on average per annum going forward.
All right, let me ask you a question, Paul. As a former city council person and as a mayor of Phoenix, I think the political dynamic that anybody in your position faces is that you want to keep taxes as low as possible, or else somebody will run against you saying you raise taxes. And you have city employees who would like raises and city departments who say we need more people. And in the normal course of events, you have to balance those two things. If you're going to pay people more or hire more people, you need to raise more funds. There's no magic answer, you know, other than that. But the question I'd ask you specifically, what doesn't fit that equation is pensions, because as a city official, you can grant very, very good pension benefits, and you'll never have to pay for that. Somebody three or four cycles down, you know, your successor 20 years later is stuck with paying that. And doesn't that create a perverse incentive to load to compensate employees with pensions that you are never going to be held responsible for paying?
Well.
And not only you personally, but anybody in public office.
First, let me just state my bias. Here's my bias. I agree with Sam's value on this one. I disagree with the tactics of what are being done with 106.
Okay.
I think 106 is the wrong way to approach it. But I agree with the value. And the point that you're
value
making,
being?
The value being that pensions and unfunded liabilities can have an effect on the city, and they have to stay conscious of it. They have to be cognizant of the effect that it can have on them. And the point that you're making is that oftentimes the people who are getting the benefit are also people who elect council members, which can then have an effect on the pension benefit without people really thinking about the cost of it. Mm-hmm. You know, pensions are like life insurance. When people say they don't work, they do work. Right. You can talk to Warren Buffett, John Arnold. There are lots of people around the country who are deeply involved in talking about pension reform, but they will tell you they work based upon the ideas of probabilities and statistics, right? Mm-hmm. We determined a long time ago through insurance how long people could live and what were the numbers that we had to apply for a
It's always based on assumptions, and those sometimes change, but
that's
yes.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Now, when you start doing things to it that change the benefit without adding a premium to it, like pension spiking, right? Mm-hmm. That was one of the problems that we had that have been not
and
cured.
Pension, explain real quick what that is.
The idea is that you know, you can pay in a certain benefit month after month after month, and in the last 3 years, go out and jump up a bunch of your overtime, spike what your value
and
is.
And then your pension's based on that.
That's right. Yeah. And you never really paid the
premium, that full freight for that.
Yeah. A second problem has
been... That's a bad pension formula.
That's right. It's a bad pension formula. Another one is the cities have been in a position where so many years the stock markets did well that they didn't have to add anything to it, so they just assumed they would keep doing that well, right?
which is why you know, like the people who say take Social Security and put it in the stock market is nonsense. Some years it'll do great, and other years
I want to point out with Phoenix we have a particularly difficult situation with PSPRS because it's a public safety personnel retirement system and the
police
largest
and
of our pension
police
funds. It's police and fire, and it is one of the most mismanaged pension funds in the country to date. So when other people were earning much more substantial returns during the good years, they were not. And structurally, we've looked with accountants. They guarantee, you know, they say they're going to have to generate a 7.2% rate of return to meet the numbers we're telling us. Their historical is 5%. We've sat down with
and that may sound like a small number, but when you project that over 20 or 30 years, it's a huge number.
Yeah, you're talking billions and dollars.
The difference between 5% and 7% is unbelievable.
It's enormous. Mm-hmm. And what has happened with them is that fund structurally cannot make 7% per year because so many of their funds, they have bonds and things like this that are guaranteed low rates of return.
Yeah.
So they're structurally.
And I would add, though, those are safe. There's also, they have an obligation to be conservative.
Oh, they
do. And bonds are that.
But if so, they need to be honest about what their annual rate of return is. Historically, it's right around 5%.
You can put it in the stock market, but if you did that in 2008, you would have lost half your money.
Right.
And so, again, the value, I agree with. Now, the tactic, I think you have to look at. This is not the only thing that's addressing this issue. Governor Ducey put a significant effort as a Republican, working with police and fire and other groups, putting a lot of people around the table, and came up with a beginning portion of the solution to start making certain that we were looking at those unfunded mandates. The city of Phoenix has taken some action, more than one, at the city council level, trying to address it, the way that they've restructured new employees versus old employees, their legacy cost versus their non-legacy cost. Those changes are beginning to make a difference, and they believe they will have that those unfunded mandates or those unfunded pension liabilities paid off within about a 20-year period of time. I've looked at the numbers, and it looks reasonable to me that they can get there. They're also improving year after year. This is not only a pretty draconian effect in terms of what's being proposed, but you know, candidly, I've now read it about five times. It is not the best written document I've ever read. In fact, it is so confusing, I have no doubt this is going to be tied up in the courts for a very long period of time in terms of what is the real effect, what is attempting to be done with this. The idea that you have to significantly impact the city's budget to pay down these deficits and you can't affect police and fire. Well, police and fire is about 70% of the budget. So here's what that means. You start hitting really, really hard parks and recreation, roads. You start affecting the ability to pay for other types of programs that are important in the city. And I can tell you this, you start having an effect on libraries, parks and recreation, after school activities. You can't hire enough cops. Right? I guarantee you the problems on the crime side begin to escalate. Mm-hmm. So this is about trying to come up with a reasonable approach, and you don't need to do it in 1 or 2 years.
Well, I asked Paul a question. I have one, yep. A couple for Sam. And that relates to, you know, this does seem to like tie the hand of council people. If in fact they are moving in this direction, so all of a sudden overnight, you've got to completely curtail other spending. You've exempted police and fire 70% of the budget. And so that means you're basically going to have to squeeze everything else.
Not at all. As a matter of fact, at least based on information we got from the city manager's office, in each of the last 3 years, this wouldn't have limited our budget increases. In other words, the budget increases would have been allowed because it allows an increase equivalent to the rate of inflation plus the rate of population growth. So in each of the last few years, that would have averaged a bit over 2%.
But we're constraining forever, so those are good years. The problem with the absolute constraint is you have to do it in bad years, too.
We're constraining until the pension fund is stabilized. Mm-hmm.
But to take that from 30% to 90% funded in you're totally constrained until you do that. That's a huge.
You're not
huge
totally
deficit.
Constrained. I mean, this year, for instance, we increased the budget by $55 million. Under this plan, you would have had the ability to increase it by a bit over $90 million. So this really does not. I mean, if we hit a bad period and inflation becomes, you know, obviously deflation, the worst case scenario, then we're going to have bigger problems than this nationwide.
Well, I'm thinking of something like an 07 type
but
crash.
An 07
revenues go down.
But an 07 type crash, we weren't raising the budget then either. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not what happens. You raise the budget when more money is coming in. So this is why it doesn't mandate any cuts at all. It doesn't ask for any pairing of the city budget, and it gives actually quite a bit of room. We didn't write in the limitations on spending on this to be draconian at all. What is meant to be draconian on this are the accounting rules that require the deficit to be accounted for in a way that is in line with what other government institutions, corporations.
I'm not sure Paul would object to that part of it.
Oh, I'm sure he won't. I mean, it's basic accounting standards, yeah. And taking an honest look at what our expenses are. That's the main effect of this. The other controls, the real world effect of them is going to be incredibly limited, if it even exists.
This strikes me as like a lot of these balanced budget proposals that at their essence say we don't trust the people we elected to behave in a responsible fashion.
You know, there's
so we're going to constrain
them. There's a site. It's kind of funny. I remember an initiative that we passed years ago on the Mountain Preserve right over here.
Your sounds like beginning of a big story. Sure. Can we go to break and start with your story when we return in just a moment in the Think Tank.
The Think Tank, KTAR News on 92.3 FM and KTAR.com.
We are back with Sam Stone and Paul Johnson, who was in the middle, or not in the middle, really, at the beginning of a story when I cut him off. Continue. We're talking, by the way, about budget limitations and pension funding in the city.
And you were also talking about initiatives and whether or not initiatives and referendums were the right way to handle it. And I'm a big supporter of initiatives and referendums.
You've run a few.
I have run a few. I think that they definitely can provide benefit. But there's
I think they when the priorities of elected bodies differ substantially from those of the public.
That's right.
Initiatives sort of force public elected officials to get in line.
And my story was going to be: I'm looking outside your window here, and I see the Squaw Peak not too far away from where we are in the Phoenix Mountain Preserve. And I remember we passed the Phoenix Mountain Preserve years ago, which I think was a good goal. It was something that was put into an initiative. It made sense. But one of the things that we said is that once you put something into the Phoenix Mountain Preserve, you can never take it out. I recall when we were trying to build this Squaw Peak through this area, there was this one parcel that if I could have moved the roadway just a little bit further to the west, would have saved a neighborhood. I couldn't do it. I had an initiative that boxed me in, that limited me from being able to do something that was
because
common
of
sense.
Voter protection.
That's right. Now, in that particular case, I think the voters made a decision that said those mountain preserves are more important than they thought it was against development, but in the end, they probably thought it was more important than that neighborhood. Right? They were willing to look at the collective.
They probably didn't think about that neighborhood.
Maybe.
And they didn't think about a road going
That's
through there.
Probably
they
what
probably
they
were voting the idea of having mountain preserves is a good thing.
You might have even done some polling back then. I recall you being around. But but here's what I know. This initiative is very poorly written. It is very dense. It has two full pages of things that they're requiring to happen, involving something that is very complex, the city budget, the pension funds, other things. Again, I agree with the value. The value that we have to be careful about those unfunded liabilities is an important thing. This is the wrong way to approach it.
You know, you never answered my question earlier.
I probably
maybe there
didn't.
Isn't the question about the perverse incentives of elected officials where, you know, I as an employer, if I can give somebody a $10,000 raise, I got to come up with $10,000 to put $100,000 in their pension. As an elected official, I don't have to come up with a nickel of that. That's my successor's problem.
So another bias. I was a Democrat. I'm today an independent. One of the things that made me an independent, I'm certainly not a modern day Republican. But one of the things that made me an independent was I do think that there are some limitations to how much government should do. No doubt about it, because of that very same concept. If you nationalize medicine, I can tell you what happens. The people who are working in medicine then go to the elected officials to get the benefits that they want.
Well, that's what happened. The doctors were the biggest opponents of Medicare when it was put in the 1960s, and they got them on board by buying them off. And physician income shot through the roof after Medicare.
I believe in creating a safety net. The safety net makes sense to me. The idea that we make certain that seniors and poor people have access to health care and that we try to minimize the amount of people who don't, I think that's important. Trying to reduce costs, that makes sense to me. But nationalizing, it's another question. Well, with public pensions, I do think we need firefighters and police officers working for the city. That makes sense to me. I do think that we ought to have a pension for them. I do think we should have a big spotlight on what we're doing with the pension funds. Why? Well, because it becomes too easy to manipulate it and to not think about the economic consequences 2, 5, 10, 20 years down the road.
And as a foreign, given that you're out of politics, maybe you can, but aren't the firefighters the most powerful political influence on the city of Phoenix?
Oh, gosh, you'll have to ask them. Here's what I will give you my answer. I will give you my answer. All right. My answer is this. What the firefighters do that is exceptional is they get involved with programs that go beyond fire. They get involved with the homeless. They get involved with CAS. They get involved in development issues. They get involved in the Planning Commission. And they become very popular. They are as popular in many respects as the New York Yankees, right?
Yeah.
The public loves them.
Anybody has a contact with a fireman, it's always a positive thing that they're there to help you.
But in my experience, and the reason I said that I will relinquish, you know, the ability to talk about what's current, when I was there, I had a huge budget crisis, massive. And I had employees ready to strike, ready to do job actions. It was one of the worst turndowns that had ever happened, 1990, when the savings and loans crashed. the firefighters came to me and they said, hey, they gave me their demands, and then I told them how tough it was going to be. And then they said, okay, look, here's what's important to us. We don't want to lay our people off, but we'll share the pain. You figure out what percent has to go to the firefighters, we'll do a furlough program. Mm-hmm. We'll let our people take time off and not get paid. We don't want to hurt the young guys. We want to make certain that the old guys share the pain with it, which was, to me, stunning that they would do it.
That is
helped me resolve that problem. I found them to be very workable. I think if you spoke to Doug Ducey, who's a Republican at the state level, when he did the pension reforms, he would tell you something very close to the same thing, that if you want to work with them, this is a group of people who take their power and utilize it in a responsible means. Now, that doesn't mean I agree with everything that they've done. Of course, they've had things that I haven't agreed with them on.
I'll tell you a little anecdote along those lines that about the ogre of unions and whatever. I was hired by the Southwest Pilots Union, and we were doing contract negotiations, and I held a series of focus groups with them. And this is old enough, I think I can share it. And I lay out, you know, my first question is sort of, what do you want? Big question like that. And the first answer I got was, we don't want to kill this beast. We own it. And I said, wow. I think that is dependent upon there being a good relationship between union and management, which they had, which it sounds like you had, which was not always the case. Sam, a couple of questions for you. And this relates to the kind of the power of the union. Doesn't your own initiative prove that power of this group? I mean, the first thing you have in there is you exempt police and fire from the spending caps?
Actually, that was more about police than it is fire, and the fact that their funding comes from essentially the same bucket, because we are about, depending on who you ask, 500 to 800 officers short right now in our police patrol.
Well, that
divisions.
Doesn't mean that absent that you'd have to cut them. It means that management gets to look at the totality.
Nobody's talking about cutting them. Yeah, yeah. This was specifically to leave the room to hire those additional officers if we're able to. So, pardon me, that was the most important thing in this initiative. But it does show the most important thing here is that we have a $1.1 billion general fund budget outside of police and fire, the monies that the city council can really move around. We go from this year at about $127 million owed for our past pension deficits to in about 10 years going over $500 million. So we may need an additional revenue source coming up. You may need to raise taxes anyway. This pension initiative, 106, the reason to vote yes on it is so that we know now and we can do it now, frankly, because if we have to do that, we can do it with a much lower rate increase now than we would down the road. We can do a lot of things now that we're not going to have options for in 10 or 20 years.
Okay, that's you get 15 seconds, Paul, to conclude.
Oh, well, first, like I said earlier, it was fun to be back in the arena a little bit. Thank you, Sam.
Thank you.
Look, this is what I found. I found the city of Phoenix is one of the best places in the country. I found that as a city, this is a can-do place. There's a population out there that wants to solve the problems, and I think we have a council, including Councilman DeCicco, who want to try to make that work. I don't support these two initiatives. I think they're wrong for the long-term vision of the city, but I always appreciate being involved in the debate.
Okay, that's our time. Thank you very much. Sam Stone, Paul Johnson, we've discussed both initiatives one way or the other. I just would urge all citizens to vote. See you next week in the Think Tank.